Welcome to the .com Magazine Entrepreneur Spotlight Series, where your host, Andy Jacob, interviews leading entrepreneurs, founders, and CEOs about their incredible companies and discusses their unique entrepreneurial journeys. If you're the CEO or founder of an exciting and exceptional company, the editorial team of .com Magazine welcomes you to pitch your business story to appear on this exciting interview series by reaching out to Mr. Jacob at .com Magazine at .commagazine.com. And without further ado, here is another amazing entrepreneurial story on the .com Magazine Entrepreneur Spotlight Series.
Hello, everybody. Andy Jacob here with the .com Magazine Entrepreneur Spotlight Series. I have a great show today. You know, everybody that watches the show, there's one thing you know about me. Besides loving technology, I love food. I love to eat. I love going out and seeing what's new in the restaurant world, of course, and coming out of, you know, this the last couple of years, restaurants are opening. So many great chefs are doing great things. And of course, I love going into the stores and seeing all the new products that are on the shelves and all the new energy bars and all the things you can eat and all the healthy things you can eat. And of course, sometimes the unhealthy things you can eat as well. But we were talking and my team said, Jake, let's bring on a leader in the field in bringing a food product to market, because that's such an interesting space. You know, you walk into the big box stores, you walk into, you know, any of the markets and you wonder, how did these products get on these shelves? Who was instrumental in helping those entrepreneurs sort of catapult their products into the stores? And of course, we brought on Mr. Jamie Valenti Jordan. He's the CEO of Catapult Commercialization Services. What a great name, by the way. He catapults products into development. What a great consulting firm he's put together. What a great leader in the field. Jamie, welcome to the .com Magazine Entrepreneur Spotlight Series today.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. You've put a great team together and you specialize in really bringing products to market. So many people reach out to you at Catapult and they say, hey, Jamie, we've heard about what you do. We need your help. But let's pull the lens back to 30,000 feet as we become very famous for now and tell us about what's happening at Catapult Commercialization Services. Then we're going to get into it.
Sure. So, we're really on the front line when it comes down to it about, bringing new products to market. So we're seeing the new trends as they literally form, as they are going from ideas into concepts and from concepts into prototypes. We are literally the group that is there converting those concepts into prototypes, taking those prototypes all the way through development, making those, refining those concepts for consumer experiences, getting them, one step further than that, even where we've built the products that are actually able to be scaled, then finding those partners with which to scale and actually taking those products to manufacturing sites and helping them conform to all the standard regulations along the way, and then even going one step further than that and getting the products into distribution and helping people activate their sales strategies and things like that. So we're I don't want to say full service. I'm an engineer, so I'll never say that everything is covered. But we have the major potholes in the path of commercialization kind of filled in for folks to help them avoid stumbling along the way.
Yeah, it's powerful. Of course, you're a certified food scientist, a chemical engineer. You're an expert in combining food science and processing really to deliver the optimum quality and cost to the consumer. Let's talk about it. Somebody has a food, they want to create something. Maybe they've got a recipe from their mother or, you know, a great brownie mix or an energy bar, whatever it is. What's the conversation sound like when they call you, Jamie, and they say, hey, we've heard about what you're doing. We want to get involved. What's that first conversation sound like with an entrepreneur?
Sure. So, at the end of the day, all entrepreneurs bring different skill sets to the table, right? So the first thing we want to do is figure out how far they've been able to get under their own power with their concept development. So it's about understanding, you know, hey, do you know who your target market is? Because it turns out, you know, most people, most entrepreneurs believe that they are their own target market, which is fine, right? But there's certainly some level of refinement and understanding that needs to go into that, because not everybody is starting a food company around that particular product. So you can't be a market size of one. So, you know, once they've got kind of that lined out, we want to understand how far in the formula development they are. So are they sourcing their ingredients from, you know, industrial sources, which is what's required under FSMA for traceability requirements and things like that. But it also means that those ingredients are then scalable. If you're bringing in ingredients from restaurant supply and other such groups, they change their suppliers all the time based on, you know, how crops come back and things like that. We need industrial sources where it's locked all the way back to the ingredient supplier. So if folks are not quite there yet, we bring in a food scientist, product developer, and help them kind of get to that point where they've got a locked down formulation that they're ready to scale. And then we kind of keep going on from there. If they've got that all that sorted out, we look at, you know, how far along is your packaging development. Most people can draw on a piece of paper what they want their packaging to look like, but do they have the ingredient? Do they have the component suppliers? Do they have the, you know, the all the pieces that they need? The dye lines set up, their graphics set up. Have they done a regulatory review to make sure that it conforms to that 600-page document that the FDA puts out that says this is what you can put on a label? Do they understand that there even is that? And then we look at, you know, how they're actually making it. Commonly, it's on the benchtop because we are usually working with entrepreneurs. So we're looking at how are they making it on the benchtop? Are the processes that they have there scalable directly, or do we need to leverage additional equipment, which really just comes from experience and doing this over and over again? So really, once we have those kind of three legs put together, where it's the formulation, the process, and the packaging, that's when we want to go find a contract manufacturer. For most people, like 90, 95% of the startups out there, they really should be at a contract manufacturer because they're not used to running operations. They may run a kitchen or something like that, but running a food plant is a different environment. It's a different set of considerations, unless you like dealing with you know, trucks that occasionally run off the road, or somebody stabs a pallet of flour with a forklift. Unless those type of things excite people, most of the time you end up at a contract manufacturer, which also allows you to tap into economies of scale on the processing side. So it brings your COGS down, right? So that's where a lot of people reach out to us. They've got a formulation, they've got packaging lined up, they've got a process that they think will scale, and they need help finding a contract manufacturer. So we'll go out and leverage kind of the relationships that we have and everything that's out there, and find those groups, bring them to the table that are interested in working with startups, because there are unique challenges in working with startups that a lot of contract manufacturers don't want to deal with. And that's their choice, right? So at the end of the day, we bring those folks to the table. We walk them through the whole process of, you know, aligning their ingredients. They may choose an ingredient from, let's say, Cargill, from ConAgra, you know, that they necessarily want to, that they want to use, and they may want to pivot to, another supplier, because the co-man is already sourcing an ingredient. It's one more thing they don't have to, put on the shelf. It'd be easier for them to just take from their existing stocks, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, we walk them through that whole process, figure out how to make it run on the equipment the contract manufacturer actually has, because that's not always trivial by its very nature. So we'll go out to the plant and support their trial runs and eventually their production runs. And then there's always a question around those, you know, contract negotiations, getting all those sorted out, and then making sure that we've got warehouses lined up and everything like that. So, yeah, I mean, it's always a question of where our clients are coming from to know how we can support them best, because it turns out at the end of the day, there's 1,000 different ways to get a product to market, and it's about customizing that to make sure that it's really going to meet your needs.
It's so interesting, Jamie, and thank you for that. I mean, that is such a well thought out and evolved explanation about what you do. So many people have an idea about a food product. You know, they have a pie and then they take the pie out to the picnic. And then everybody says at the picnic, wow, this is a great pie. You should get into business. And they start thinking about how to get the pie into business. But when you develop a new idea for a product, you know, because this pie is going to be the greatest pie in the world in this particular case, developing that idea is the next evolution. And then developing the process into something that can be commercially produced requires experience and skill from someone like you and your team that's been in the business for so long, because to try and do it on your own, it's almost impossible these days, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I won't say that it's impossible. There's certainly a lot of people who have done some very interesting things. But I think at the end of the day, you know, there's certainly some level of technical competence about what equipment already exists out there, right? And so at the end of the day, if you can leverage what already exists, then you're not necessarily trying to purchase and install and bring online a new system that somebody's not familiar with and then hoping that it runs day one, right? That is kind of the nightmare scenario there associated with trying to get a new product up and running. Oh, and you go.
Jamie, that's awesome. Now let's talk about it, because somebody has a pie, right? And they love making pies. They go to the picnic, they go to the family events, and everybody says, wow, you should get in the pie business. So now they start thinking about developing a pie company. But the idea of building a company is a great thing for people to think about. We're entrepreneurs and we love that when people think entrepreneurial, but developing that idea and the processes into that idea to make it something that's commercially viable is so difficult. Now, some people can do it on their own, but most people reach out to the experts like you. So for the people that reach out to the experts like you, how long does it take to get from point A to B once they have the idea to get it on the shelves in the stores?
Oh my, that's going to be extremely variable. They're, you know, if they're at the point where they've got, let's say, grandma's recipe for a pie, and they're sourcing their ingredients from, you know, from local sources. Honestly, let's see here. It's probably a solid year before you get product on the shelf. The reason why is that it takes time to go through that formulation step where you source industrial ingredients, make sure that grandma's pie still tastes like grandma's pie after you use somebody else's, you know, Crisco oil or whatever. And then, you know, you have to find that contract manufacturer once you've got all that packaging lined up as well. And as you scale into this, it can just take a long time, especially in the current times that we're in right now. It can take a good long time to negotiate all those agreements and whatnot and actually get product through the process and in a truck and ready to be sold. So, yeah, I mean, I'd say you're probably looking at a solid year before you're knocking on doors and trying to sell the pies into retailers.
I love it, Jamie. Of course, your team has the expertise in packaging development and optimization. Of course, you have this expertise in supply chain development, which is so important. And of course, contract manufacturing, sourcing and optimization. Again, when we think about it though, let's break it down, because, you know, I go into the store and I see some of these items that are right up front and they have great shelf space and they're sort of right in my face when I walk in. So a lot of people don't really understand the food business. So does it take money to get into the big box stores and be placed in an area that's going to attract attention from the potential consumer?
If you want to be the one specifying where your product is necessarily going to be displayed within some of these stores, yes, you're going to be paying slotting fees. Many of these stores right now, though, recognize emerging brands as a key driver for moving their existing clientele a certain direction to ones that have more, let's say, discretionary spending. And so there's been a huge push from the retailer side to pull in emerging brands that may not normally conform to their certain set of identity of certain products that they would not necessarily want to bring in. So to that respect, you know, Costco has been consuming, you know, a lot of in and outs. They've been doing a lot of in and outs lately, pulling products in, putting them on shelf for 3 months, getting people a lot of exposure that are emerging brands. But the reorders just aren't there. And that's for obvious reasons, right? They've got to make room for the next set of emerging brands that they're bringing in. But that type of rotational stock is really appealing to the folks who tend to go to Costco, because what they want to do is say, well, you know, FOMO is driving me to go back to Costco this month, because if I don't, then the product that I'm looking for that I thought was really good will be gone. And so with that in mind, you know, a lot of people have been landing Costco and seeing that as kind of the beginning of their hockey stick, just to find out that it might be more of, you know, just a ramp that they jump off of. So, I mean, you've got to leverage that, pivot that, use that to get into other places. You can't just fall back on, well, Costco took us, so we're all set. It's something where you have to lean in.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I love that you mentioned that lean in. And of course, you're an expert. Your clients lean on you to tell them, you know, how to lean in and what to do next after they land a big store, how to sort of monetize that opportunity. When I go to the big box store, I go to the grocery store. One thing that comes to mind, Jamie, is I walk down, you know, the frozen food aisle, and I'm looking at all this frozen food, and I'm saying to myself, man, that has to be an entirely different process when something's refrigerated versus something that's not refrigerated. So maybe just high level without getting too much into detail, because I think you could probably talk about that for 30 days, let alone a few minutes. What's the differentiator between the frozen, you know, products and the ones that, you know, have a shelf life not being frozen?
Right. So, yeah, I could probably teach a course on this. I teach both food processing and food engineering at the moment. You know, the advantage to products that are frozen, assuming that they can withstand the freeze-thaw cycle, is that you get many, many, many more months worth of shelf life out of them over a refrigerated product. That has to do with immobilizing water and blah, 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 blah. Long story short, you know, because of that, the frozen sector is very challenging to get into, mainly because a lot of people are in that space and there's only so much installed infrastructure inside of the retailers. So they're not going to add more freezer space just because your product is amazing. You have to find someone to kick out. Their planograms are set, so you have to find somebody that you can beat on shelf and increase their velocities above and beyond what they're currently getting. So not only would they like to sell your product that's going to occupy a certain number of linear inches, they're going to want to sell the adjacent products faster as well. So if you can prove that you generate a halo effect in generating other products that sell more quickly because your product is there, you can definitely land in that space. Refrigerated, completely different story. Very quick shelf lives. So you have to have, you know, very quick distribution channels to meet those needs. So you're necessarily going to have to work on, you know, a much shorter timeline, and you're going to have to be producing product more frequently because you can't just make it once and then store it for 12 months. Frozen, you have the advantage of, you can take advantage of very large economies of scale and then freeze it for, you know, 6 months at a time, and just kind of play through that inventory. But as you look at refrigerated, you're producing probably every 20 days, life is 45 to 90 days. So, you know, you have to look at, you know, properly sizing your contract manufacturer so that they don't say, hey, your minimum order is 10,000 units, but you can only sell 200 every 20 days. That's going to lead you down the wrong path very quickly.
Jamie, that's so interesting. Is there a starter package? In other words, let's say you do all the work and we're ready to go and my pie is ready to, you know, get sent out there. Is there sort of a basic package that the big box stores sort of look like? Do they test it in a market? Do they test it in a certain number of stores before they go nationwide? Or is it depending on the product? And the second part of that question is, how does the big box store know whether it's a success? Is there a percentage ratio of sell through that they have to hit before they start ordering more and more product?
Yeah. So when you look at it that way, you know, a lot of stores are, they're looking for a velocity. They're looking for a certain number of units sold per week, per store. And they have a certain category that each buyer will manage. So one will do sauces, one will do canned foods. And so what they're trying to do is drive higher and higher velocities, because every time they sell a product, they get generally 30-35% markup from what you sell it to them for, or I should say they buy it from the distributor. But in any case, so what they're trying to look at is total dollars per linear inch of their shelf. So, you know, when you look at how they're going to think about this, each buyer is going to have a different category that they manage, which is going to have its own set of metrics. So every buyer is going to set up different types of deals, whether it's, hey, let's get you in one store and see how you do, because we think this store has the right clientele for your target market. Again, we're tying it all the way back to the design of the product, because their clientele has to necessarily align to your target market, or else it's not going to move anyway, right? You're in front of the wrong people. It's like advertising online to people that don't meet your target set. So at the end of the day, it's about, you know, making that relationship with those buyers, which, you know, you may or may not have direct access to because you're a startup. You may have to go through a broker. But many of them are willing to take chances on a product for 30 to 90 days, put it on shelf and see how it does. If they see velocities that exceed what they had on that shelf before or something else that they can move out, then they're going to put you there. Now, that said, they have to still have a mix of things. For example, if mayonnaise is moving faster than ketchup, they're not going to throw all the ketchup off the shelf and just have mayonnaise. They have to have the mix, or else the clientele stop coming to that section because they can't find what they need, regardless of what is out there, right? So it's a complicated jigsaw puzzle, you know, and you know, there's a pulling back the veil a little bit. There's a little bit of a bias within the technical sector of the food industry that, you know, a lot of buyers don't necessarily know their categories as well as the groups that are coming to pitch their products. So you may have to educate a buyer, or maybe even sometimes a broker, about the consumer set and what they buy in order to kind of help them understand how your product helps meet their needs. So there's always some sort of education that can take place in these kind of sales pitches.
Oh, very interesting. What a great business. What a matrix, I call it. Let's do the economics just real briefly. It costs, in my pie scenario, it costs a dollar to put my pie together, all the ingredients with the packaging. What do they sell that for at the big box store? And is there an intermediary that also gets their hands on it to sell it to the big box store?
Right. So when you're talking about it costs me a dollar, that would mean that you have spent a dollar to get your ingredients and your packaging materials. You've paid your contract manufacturer to combine those materials into a product and put it on a pallet. That pallet now sits at the back of that contract manufacturer's facility, hasn't gone anywhere. So the first thing you're going to want to do is pay someone to take it somewhere. Otherwise, there's no consumer that's going to pick it up at the back of that warehouse. So you have a distributor. They're the ones who actually drive the trucks. They also own the warehouses. They're going to take control of your inventory. So literally, they are going to pay you for your product. That is where your actual cash comes from, is from the distributor. The distributor is going to pay you for the product so that you can pay the contract manufacturer. And so that distributor will get it where it needs to go based on who you have sold it to. So they've got agreements that, you know, hey, this retailer is serviced by this trucking company. I'm going to reduce it down to, you know, an absurdum in just a second here. But basically, you know, the trucking company has an agreement that only they can drive their trucks in. The reason why they want to do that is they don't want to have 55 trucks arrive at a store each day, unloading half a pallet each, right? So they want to consolidate. So they contract with a single trucking company, so everyone has to take it to their warehouse. So your distributor is going to take it to that warehouse and, you know, make sure that it gets all the way into the various stores. Your retailer is going to take your product and put it on shelf, and they're going to charge a markup as well. So not only do the does the distribution company need to pay for their warehouses and pay for their trucks and pay for their gas and pay all their people, but you've also got the retailer who is basically you are purchasing the right to sell your product to their clientele. So you're buying with the kind of cost that's getting charged through to consumer, you're buying the right to access their audience, their you know, their existing community that they live in. And in so doing, you know, they're going to charge generally 30 to 35% markup, depending on the category, depending on the store and the buyer and all that stuff. The distributor, turns out most of the time it comes out to be somewhere between 25 and 35%, depending on whether or not you're talking about refrigerated product, frozen product, and whatnot. So your $1 very quickly goes to almost $2 by the time you add all of those together. And that's kind of what your consumer might see, but that's going to have to be inclusive of everything else. So when I say everything else, you're not going to sell it for a dollar to the distributor. The reason why you're not going to sell it for a dollar is that's what it costs you to make it. That has nothing to do with cost of sales, let alone paying yourself or your people or your overhead or anything like that. So in reality, you're looking at probably marking it up yourself from that dollar to, you know, probably a buck 30-ish, maybe more than that, depending on where you are in your growth phase. But, you know, you're looking at a buck 30, then the distributor gets a hold of it. It's now, almost $2. By the time the retailer gets a hold of it, it's well over 250 at this point. So by the time you multiply everything out, you know, you're if you're putting it on sale and things like that, your consumer's probably looking at 250, 275, even though your cost of ingredients and your packaging is so low, just because everyone needs to have, basically when you make a food product, everyone else gets paid. And if there's anything left over, you get it.
I love it. It's great. But people do so well with food products, of course, with your direction at Catapult Commercialization, your team, you have a remarkable team that works with you. I know I'm keeping you over, but I find this such a fascinating space. Jamie, I just have a couple more questions for you. You know,
sure.
Let's stay with my pie scenario. So my pie is going like gangbusters. You know, the big box stores are going crazy. The clients are going crazy. People are grabbing them off the shelves. I've got good space. You know, the remarkable story. Now, do I have a connection technologically to the big box store so that I know at a moment's notice how many are selling, how many are sitting on the shelf, how many are left, how many are coming up to the due date? Is that all put together through software or not?
The short answer is probably not. In reality, usually you can get visibility into what a particular retailer might have at their warehouse. But once it goes to store, you won't know much of anything. There are retailers that are exceptions to that. But in general, unless you are a very large group, they won't give you access to any type of data they have in that respect anyway. It's just too expensive to set it up and too risky, frankly.
Wow. So interesting. Of course, you help so many companies. Your team is amazing. Before I let you go, though, we have to talk about entrepreneurship. I mean, you've got an amazing entrepreneurial story. I mean, you know, you've been 15 years with Campbell's Soup and Del Monte, and, you know, you really have the background. I mean, you're a leader. But along the way, I would imagine you hit some potholes. And we have younger entrepreneurs that watch the show, and maybe they're hitting a pothole in the road right now. I'm hoping you might be able to share some insight to the younger entrepreneurs watching the show, Jamie, about what it takes to get through a tough time as an entrepreneur.
I think there's another course to be taught in there about that as well. But, you know, the short answer at the end of the day, the short and sweet is scrappy. That means necessarily finding the duct tape that you have lying around and, you know, holding everything together. It's the sleepless nights. It does eventually get better. I can promise you that, especially as you surround yourself with the people that are able to take things off your plate and, you know, lean on them more and more as they understand how the business works and how they necessarily can assist you with it. But I would say, you know, I literally, what was it, a year and a half ago, I built a piece of machinery out of 5 gallon buckets and an old AC unit in my living room right around Christmas time. My family and friends came over and said, what in the heck are you doing? I'm like, I got to load this up and drive it from Wisconsin down to Florida the day after Thanksgiving so that we can run a trial. And so I need to test to make sure that it works before we go. Because I was literally sawing the bottoms off of 5 gallon buckets and things like that. So, you know, it's not pretty, and it's not graceful. And, you know, you need to have that kind of support network wherever you are, that you can lean on, especially in these times. You know, keeping an eye on, what matters most, taking the time to step back as needed, can really help you kind of center, and really give you that entrepreneurial juice that's necessary, which is that scrappy mentality of, well, no one else is going to do it. I guess I'm going to do it. Let's do it now. There's no time like the present. So, you know, if that's any type of inspiration to anyone, I hope that helps. But yeah, definitely it's about rolling up your sleeves and getting it done.
I love it. Wow. I'm going to bring you back on the show and devote the entire 30 minutes to being scrappy. I mean, I love that story so much, and you've got so much to share. I mean, it's so easy to understand why you love to educate others about what you do, and you're a leader in the space. And of course, so many companies reach out to Catapult and they say, hey, catapult me to, you know, where we want to go. And it's a great name as well. Great branding. You've got a great team. Pardon me for keeping you over, but I just love what's going on in the food space. I find it so fascinating because we all eat and we all sort of take it for granted how it gets from point A to Z. So you're a leader, Jamie. Thank you so much for coming on the .com Magazine Entrepreneur Spotlight Series, sharing all the insights, sharing the education, and putting your clients at the forefront of everything that you do.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And remember, food revolutions won't launch themselves.